Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Toby Webb. And joining me in this podcast is David Westlake, who is CEO of the International Justice Mission. Now, David, welcome. That's an ambitious name, isn't it, the International Justice Mission? So tell us briefly, what kind of mission are you on for international justice?
So thank you. And we started 20 years ago in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. And the basic thought was, can justice systems around the world, the police, the prosecutors, the court systems, can they actually deliver justice and protection consistently and constantly for the poorest, most vulnerable people? That was the guiding thought. We got into the slavery area because slavery is one of the most brutal manifestations of when justice is failing vulnerable people. And today we work in 17 places around the world actively. And we work with local justice systems to rescue victims, to prosecute perpetrators, to see them convicted, to train the police and the prosecutors and so on to make that possible, and to obviously work with survivors in a whole aftercare system.
And where does the money come from?
The money comes largely from individuals, from some trusts, and from some community groups like churches or the Rotary Club, those kinds, all those kinds of things. But over the last couple of years, the advent of the modern slavery acts around the world has opened up a new front in the fight against slavery and also opened up new partnerships with some big corporates.
And let's talk about that. I'd like to talk mainly in this podcast about Thailand. It's been in the news a lot the last few years. And from what we heard yesterday here at our Modern Slavery Conference, it's getting a bit better, but it's by no means fixed yet. No. So specifically, what are you doing in Thailand and what's the role of big business in working with you to help try and get some of this very difficult work around enforcement and rescue of victims done?
Thailand, like most other jurisdictions in the world, has some completely adequate slavery legislation. The issue is how well is it being understood and implemented on the ground. So we were in a conversation with Walmart, the world's largest retailer, who gain a lot of their shrimp products from the Gulf of Thailand and the Thai fishing fleet in the Gulf of Thailand. And they were aware that there was a problem here. They could do audits and so on for their tier one, maybe their tier two suppliers, but their supply chain is longer and more complex than that. And so they were concerned that the Modern Slavery Act put an obligation on them. I think they were concerned because nobody actually wants to be involved with slavery. And they were concerned because they had a brand reputation risk as well. So what to do? They talked to us about, let's first of all find out what is the scale of the problem in the Thai fishing fleet. Let's start with an evidence base. And we did a tool that we've used around the world called a prevalence study, which takes the desk research, it takes knowledge and wisdom from a number of actors and organisations, but also matches that with on-the-ground physical research of what's going on. And that showed that in the Thai fishing fleet, there was around 70% chance of slavery having been
What are the numbers?
Occurred.
What's the total number of people? More or less. Hundreds of thousands? Tens of thousands?
It's something like a couple of hundred thousand people.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a big industry. And so around 70% of people were exhibiting one of the signs of slavery having happened to them. So coercion, violence, theft of or removal of documents and so on. So what that meant for Walmart was, even if they were as clean as it was possible to be, they were swimming in a swamp. And even if they dived in clean, they were coming up muddy because it was a cesspit. We said to them, it is not your job to clean up the Thai fishing fleet. It's just not your job. It's the government's job. So how can you, as a corporate citizen, a good corporate citizen, mm-hmm. use your influence, your contacts, your money to help that process? So we designed a project there working with Thai police, which helped that police force and the prosecutors and the officials behind all of that to identify where slavery was happening, plan rescues and raids, arrest the perpetrators and see those cases come through the court. So that's what we're doing now.
And where is that at the moment in terms of numbers? You said earlier it's the session we just ran, it's early days.
It is.
But give us some
idea
of where
it's at. The first couple of hundred people saved from slavery, so rescued, and we've seen about eight people through the court system to date. We would expect that to increase in scale and scope as the years go by. We built this model on sex trafficking, and the Gates Foundation did research on the model in the Philippines. And over a four-year period, this approach of building evidence, arresting perpetrators, saw a 79% drop in the number of children being sold for sex in the sex industry in Cebu.
So the scale bit is not necessarily about getting to 10,000 convictions. It's about at what point does what you have done send a message?
Indeed.
And so how do you work out what that point is? How do you know when the message has been sent? I guess you see over time a right kind of drop in.
So what we will then go back and do is a prevalence study, okay, which says, having got a baseline,
yeah,
really what's happened.
Yes, so I've got 5 years later or yeah, something you can work it out. And what I really like about this Walmart Foundation funding you've got is it's not them saying, let's clean up our supply chain and have an island of excellence in a cesspit or whatever, which you see a lot with companies,
yeah,
or walk away, you know, stuff. But also that they're tackling a genuine institutional problem. How long is the project with them? And because that's the other challenge, is this is a long-term thing,
yeah,
right? So that, what happens in 5 years with them? What's the length of this?
Yeah, so we'll review this with them, or they'll review it with us in terms of funding thing in a couple of years' time. So it'll be like a five-year project.
Okay.
But the project that we will do will continue. We think, from other settings, in other sorts of places, we think that in a period of around 12 years, you see demonstrable change.
12 years?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
And partly that's about, it just takes time to take things through court systems.
Of course. And so what you're doing is you're hiring or funding undercover journalism investigators, and what you're doing is you're saying to the police, here's a load of research. If you go and raid this factory or whatever, you will find this, and here's all the evidence you need to get a conviction.
Yeah.
So that they go, okay, that's worth our time and effort.
Yeah. So
is that the majority of your work, or are you also running training classes where the cops sit down in front of a PowerPoint slide and you tell them what human rights is? I mean, what's the balance?
So it's all of the above. So we work really closely with the police. It's not our, we don't have the authority to investigate. The police have the authority to investigate.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You don't
so
want to do
their job. We work with the police in helping them do that. We provide some skills gaps sometimes. We provide some extra manpower to do that, to get that evidence and the chain of evidence well and strong. Alongside that, though, is absolutely training. So some of that is just about training people in what their own laws say and how to get those kinds of cases through the courts. Some of it, we're really aware of the complexity around taking vulnerable people, brutalised people, through giving evidence, presenting evidence in court, being cross-examined. So some of it is about just helping court systems cope with those vulnerable people.
And helping witnesses cope with the process.
And helping witnesses cope with the process. So we've done things where we've trained magistrates, we've trained police officers, we've trained prosecutors.
This is such a fascinating area, and I've spoken to you before that I wrote my master's dissertation about this. 10 years ago, I did a report on this, and I remember my case studies no longer exist, basically. And some of the companies that did them don't even know that they did them. And it's been a personal fascination of mine that we could fix these problems if we focused some time and resources on them, or we could contribute as a sort of business movement, if you like, in sustainability. Yet nobody does, really. Who else is doing this apart from you guys? Do you know about other organisations that are doing this kind of work?
Oh, I mean, I think what we're seeing in the world at the moment is a whole wave of abolitionist movement, of anti-slavery organisations. And I think my sense is that there's lots of organisations that have one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. So our piece of the jigsaw puzzle is about this casework model and taking that through, and that's what we do. There are other organisations that are doing community-based education, that are doing all sorts of other things.
But there needs to be another 10 of you guys doing what you do specifically, I would argue.
Yes.
Or would that create 10 different systems? But then you can't have one giant NGO, I guess, can you?
So I think one of the things that we've seen that's been really encouraging in India is that we have worked with another 30 organisations in India to take our experience and learning a model so that they can replicate that.
The grassroots kind of...
Yeah.
Empowerment and, approach.
And that will, I think, as there's much more sharing of the intellectual property, as there's much more sharing of the experience.
It's all open source.
It brings a momentum.
And then they have local buy-in because they're local people.
Indeed.
And you can help them get funding. Let's talk about the police again specifically. You've mentioned to me in the past, I think, that 1 in 20 police chiefs wanted to talk to you in Thailand. Is that changing?
No, so this is the internal anecdote about when we enter a setting, that there's roughly 20% of the police, and indeed the district officials system and everything, who are utterly colluding with organised crime. They've got their hands in the till. They're part of the problem. You've got 20% of the people who are appalled that this stuff's going on in their country. They're offended by it. Their sense of justice and right cause bristles, and they want to do something about it. They got into law enforcement in order to enforce the law. And you've got a whole lump in the middle who, frankly, are overworked and underpaid and stressed out.
Yeah, and they're just trying to get through the week.
And they're getting through the week.
So how do we get the good 20% to tip the middle 60% against the bad 20%. How does that work?
Yeah, so I think one of the most effective ways we've found is an absolute social movement approach, which is you find somebody who's really doing good stuff and they've done good stuff, and you make a lot of noise about them. You put them up for awards and you do PR around them, so they're in the paper, and you lobby for their promotion, and suddenly that's the good person. That's the successful person.
You make good
person.
Aspirational.
Yeah.
Thai fishing industry in general, big splash about it, no pun intended, a few years ago. By what percentage has it improved? If I had to ask you, I'm asking you these ridiculous questions about, asking you to put specifics on very difficult areas, I know that. But I'm just trying to get a sense of progress here. I mean, Thai Union have totally changed their entire business model, as far as I understand, in terms of how they work with ships as a result of this. But that cleans up their supply chain, which is kind of their job in a way.
Yeah.
And I know they've done lots of government lobbying as well
on
broader human rights issues. I know that. They've done, I think, a really interesting job. But what about the rest of it? There's you guys, Walmart, Thai Union, is the rest of it moving, or is it sort of bumbling along?
So the experience of what we've had in different parts of the world is that, and this is what the Gates Foundation found when they researched our model, is that two things happen. One is the situation in that setting improves because people who are buying and selling other people are in prison and not doing it. But there's a multiplier effect, which says that buying and selling humans in that setting has suddenly become more dangerous for the traffickers. So it's a less attractive business opportunity. And that effect is very, very powerful. So I mentioned in the Philippines, we saw drops of 79 to 84% over a period of 4 years of minors being involved in the sex industry. In Thailand, we would expect something similar to that over a period of time, because it just becomes more dangerous. People who traffic young men or children from Cambodia into the fishing fleet are going to get caught, or they're scared they're going to get caught.
Yeah,
and
deterrence. Yeah.
There's a real deterrence.
So you feel like they're going in the right direction?
Yes, yes. And there's all sorts of other things that need to go alongside that. So education
and
good working practice and all that kind of stuff as well.
And the institutions need to be strengthened. So if you get numbers like you have in the Philippines, they look great for 5 or 10 years, and then 15 years later you've slipped back to where you were if you're not careful, right?
Yeah.
So it's the solidity of functioning institutions.
Yeah.
That's a next level challenge, I guess.
And this is where actually the social movement of global recognition comes in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cambodian police, we worked with them over a period of about 15 years. Again, that was about minors in the sex industry, where Cambodia was an absolute mecca for Western sex tourism. Well, the Cambodian police now have a world-class anti-trafficking unit that's fighting minors in the sex industry.
And that's had a big impact on...
And that has a big impact. But also, it's a massive impact in terms of the standing of Cambodia and the pride of the law enforcement and the country in that. And you see some of the advantages of some of these global league tables and reports and everything is that countries don't want to be at the bottom.
No.
So there's something there about having made an improvement, you keep that improvement.
Now, you're also working with Target. That's a big US retailer. Just to finish off, tell us about that.
Well, so Target, very, very similar kind of thought process. They have a whole web of suppliers across India. And they were really aware that, again, they could do audits, which would get them so far.
Yeah.
But the people coming into the factories, the web of factories that they used, it was a murky world. And so they identified with them particularly the need for safe migration practices. So lots in India of people moving from rural settings to cities.
Mm-hmm.
How could that work, and how could they be protected there? Very similar model of what we do on the ground.
And that's a new partnership. So it's just
a new partnership
in its early stages.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see how that pans out. We'll sit down again in a year or so and have a further chat about it. In the meantime, David Westlake, thank you so much for your time today. Listeners, if you'd like to know more about IJM, just Google International Justice Mission, and I'm sure you can see more on their website. In the meantime, David, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.